Good evening, friends. Over the past couple of years, we've gathered together in this program, and there have been a variety of talks on a variety of subjects associated with various aspects of the divine plan. And so when I was trying to think of what subject to talk about, I figured I'd take a chance and actually talk about the divine plan. So we'll see how that goes. Basically, what I wanted to do was talk about three aspects. Obviously, the divine plan is a very broad subject. If you were to begin to study it in depth, whether from a historical perspective or just thematically and so on, it would take course after course, and you still wouldn't exhaust the subject. So obviously, in one talk, there's not much that I could cover, just some highlights, a kind of an overview. And so what I'm hoping to do is cover first just an overview of the past period of time that we've been attempting to execute the divine plan, and give particular attention as a second part to this past 12 years that we've been focusing on since the four-year plan began. And then finally, I want to look at the characteristics and qualities of the individuals who are supposed to execute this plan. It was a little more than 90 years ago that Abdu'l-Bahá wrote the 14 tablets in two periods in 1916 and 1917 that constitute the divine plan and sent them to the Baha'is in North America. Shoghi Effendi said, "This plan is divine in origin, is guided by the explicit and repeated instructions that have flowed from the pen of the center of the covenant himself. It is energized by the all-compelling will of its author. It claims as the theater for its operation territory spread over five continents and the islands of the seven seas. It must continue to function ere its purpose is achieved throughout successive epochs in the course of the formative age of the Baha'i dispensation. It is destined to be traversed at a cost of infinite toil and of heroic self-sacrifice. Its divine commander is Abdu'l-Bahá. It's the mightiest plan ever generated through the creative power of the Most Great Name. It holds within it the seeds of the world's spiritual revival and ultimate redemption. This plan," the Guardian said, "will be increasingly regarded as an agency designed not only for the enlargement of the limits of the faith and the multiplication of its institutions over the face of the planet, but for the acceleration of the construction and completion of the administrative framework of Baha'u'llah's embryonic world order, hastening thereby the advent of that golden age which must witness the proclamation of the Most Great Peace and the unfoldment of that world civilization which is the offspring and primary purpose of that peace." The Guardian said that the successful carrying out of our various plans is the greatest sign we can give of our faith and inner assurance, and the best way that we can help our fellow men out of their confusion and difficulties. O peoples of the earth, Baha'u'llah said, haste ye to do the pleasure of God, and war ye valiantly, as it behooveth you to war, for the sake of proclaiming his resistless and immovable cause. The blessed person of the Promised One, Abdu'l-Bahá wrote, is interpreted in the Holy Book as the Lord of Hosts, the heavenly armies. By heavenly armies, those souls are intended who are entirely freed from the human world, transformed into celestial spirits, and have become divine angels. Such souls are the rays of the Sun of Reality who will illumine all the continents. Like unto the apostles of Christ who were filled with him, these souls also have been filled with his holiness Baha'u'llah. That is, the love of Baha'u'llah has so mastered every organ, part, and limb of their bodies as to leave no effect from the promptings of this human world. These souls are the armies of God and the conquerors of the East and the West. Should one of them turn his face towards some direction and summon the people to the kingdom of God, all the ideal forces and lordly confirmations will rush to his support and reinforcement. Singly and alone, he will attack the armies of the world, defeat the right and left wings of the hosts of all countries, break through the lines of the legions of all nations, and carry his attack to the very centers of the powers of the earth. This is the meaning of the Lord of Hosts. The heroic band of the warriors of Baha'u'llah, Shoghi Effendi explains, is battling in his name and by his aid for the purification, the unification, and the spiritualization of a morally and spiritually bankrupt society, now hovering on the brink of self-destruction. In every continent of the globe and throughout the widely scattered islands, this mighty plan is forging ahead, gaining momentum with every passing day, tearing down barriers in all climes and amidst diverse peoples and races, widening irresistibly the scope of its beneficent operations and revealing ever more compelling signs of its inherent strength as it marches toward the spiritual conquest of the entire planet. Well, I guess there's not much more to be said, but I have to fill a little bit more time, so. When soon after revealing those plans, those tablets to the Baha'is of North America, Abdul Baha passed away. And Shoghi Effendi undertook his mission as the guardian. One of the key elements that he saw of his work was the need to execute this divine plan. And so immediately he was interested in moving the army of Baha'u'llah forward in the prosecution of this plan. But he saw that the Baha'is really didn't have the capacity in order to execute this plan in a systematic way. So he first had to direct the energies of the Baha'is toward the building of the administrative order. So the systematic execution of the plan was held in abeyance for about 16 years, a period of incubation, where Shoghi Effendi patiently taught the friends about Baha'i administration, how to raise their local and national assemblies, which would become the machinery to carry out this systematic execution of the plan. Up to that point, individuals had arisen and carried out different acts of service under the framework of the plan, heroic services like those of Martha Root. But Shoghi Effendi pointed out that a lot of what Martha Root did, for example, was lost because she would go and sow the seeds, but there was no one to follow up, no framework to patiently nurture those seeds and help them grow. So without the machinery of the administration, the plan could not be executed in a systematic way. Finally, after patiently working all those years, Shoghi Effendi was able to encourage the Baha'is in North America to adopt the first national plan, the seven-year plan. This began a series of plans that national communities would begin to implement in order to begin the process of carrying out the teaching work in a more systematic way. Now the objectives, there's a lot of different objectives to different plans in different parts of the world and so on, but they had some basic characteristics that were similar. In this first seven-year plan, for example, the Baha'is of North America were told to spread out, to open the unopened states and provinces of that region. and also then to carry the faith into Central America and then also into South America. So this became fundamental characteristic of these first plans, to build the administrative machinery, raise up local and national assemblies, but also to spread out, open new areas, establish new communities, and raise up local assemblies, and then move across the border and open new territories beyond the home front. Now, other national communities, one by one, as they became strong, this became a sign of their maturity, that they would be also able to adopt one of these national plans. So, for example, at one point, Shoghi Effendi wrote to the Baha'is in Australia and New Zealand and encouraged them to start their own national plan. And he wrote and he said, "Their period of adolescence in the faith has passed. They are now adults, and they must face the problems involved in fulfilling their plan squarely and with maturity. The pleasant period of youthful irresponsibility, when they could look on the work of the American and Persian communities as the feats of the strong, which they were not called upon to emulate, being too young, is now past." So one by one, national community after national community would become mature, would take on its own national plan. The characteristics, again, were fundamentally the same. Spread out, teach, raise up local assemblies, spread out beyond your borders in natural ways to open new country and territories in parts of the world. So these various national plans, there was a second national plan in North America, the second seven-year plan. This, again, carried on the other objectives of spreading out, forming assemblies, spreading in the Central and South America, but added to it was now to go and help reinforce the communities in Europe, which were uprooted by World War II. Finally, in 1951, a few national assemblies that existed were able to come together and establish the first international plan, which was the African Crusade, where five national spiritual assemblies collaborated together to accelerate the systematic work for the spread of the faith in Africa. And then the crowning stage of the execution of the divine plan during the ministry of the Guardian was the initiation of the 10-year crusade, which is the first global plan. And in this plan, all of the national assemblies that existed came together in a single plan. At that time, there were 12 national spiritual assemblies. They came together, and then they were able to begin to open the remaining territories and unopened countries across the planet. Now, Shoghi Effendi envisioned that after the 10-year crusade, that there would be a series of plans that were carried out under the direction of the Universal House of Justice. And the House of Justice would unify the action of national communities in the execution of those plans. So immediately after the House of Justice was formed in 1963, it began the process of organizing the next global plan, which was the 9-year plan, which began in 1964. Each of these plans that the House of Justice established began to take on, they would carry forward all of the existing goals and objectives that Shoghi Effendi had laid down. But then they would highlight various aspects in addition to those objectives. For example, in the 9-year plan, there was a focus on a vast expansion of the Baha'i community and universal participation by those believers. So the series of plans by Shoghi Effendi was kind of like laying the skeleton of the faith, its nervous system stretching out all over the planet. Now that that process of spreading out had been undertaken, now it was necessary to kind of add some meat to those bones. We needed more believers, and we needed to make sure that those believers were active in the community. The next plan, the 5-year plan after that, from 1974 to 1979, focused on aspects of community building. multiplying communities that would hold holy days, activities for women, children's classes, that the local assemblies would be established and hold regular meetings. These were all aspects of a community building process that was now added to the previous focus on teaching and spreading out and involving new believers in action. Following that was the 7-year plan, which added additional objectives to those other ones. Social and economic development became part of that plan. Also a greater involvement in the life of society. The external affairs work was vastly developed during that 7-year plan. By the time of the next plan, the 6-year plan, there were 7 objectives to that 6-year plan. These included carrying the healing message of Baha'u'llah to humanity, to develop Baha'i literature, focus on the maturation of community life, of individual participation and spiritual enrichment, in extending education and strengthening the family, and in social and economic development. And these were kind of the fruition of all these years of plans, one by one, objective after objective, being added, various threads, all coming into being, now attained a certain state of maturity when all of these objectives could be pursued, and the national assemblies themselves, along with the counselors, would make the plans for the various communities. This then was followed by the 3-year plan, when the House of Justice said the same 7 objectives would be carried forward, but in addition to that would be a focus on the development of human resources for the pursuit of these objectives. Now, all of these plans from the period, in a certain sense, you could break it down into one group under the Ministry of the Guardian. This next group of plans, from the 9-year plan to the 3-year plan, all involved adding various aspects, community building, social and economic development, in a certain sense, developing capacities in the community that weren't there, that needed to be strengthened. But they were kind of like laying out individual threads. We would have this objective, and then we would also educate the children, and then we would also engage in development, and we would also strengthen our LSA, and so on. Another feature that emerged near the end of the Guardian's lifetime was the entry into this stage of where he said that the first signs on the horizon of a process of entry by troops began to emerge. This was in Uganda, in other countries in Africa, in Indonesia. The first signs of people, a stage foretold by Abdu'l-Bahá, when people wouldn't become Baha'is just one by one, but by hundreds, and then by thousands. This began even during Shoghi Effendi's lifetime. And it began to accelerate then, especially in the 9-year plan. A number of countries saw the process of entry by troops begin and accelerate, and gradually it spread to other parts of the world. Now, by the 6-year plan in 1998 to 1990, 2 years of that plan, this process reached a peak in where we witnessed 1 million people become Baha'is in a 2-year period. So we went from about 4 to 5 million people in just a couple of years. Now, we learned to master this capacity of bringing, touching people's hearts and bringing them to the faith, but then we didn't know what to do with them after they would become Baha'i so quickly. A small group of dedicated teachers would focus on teaching the faith, and they would be successful at it, but then there weren't enough human resources to teach those people, to educate them, to teach their children, to help them form local assemblies. So only a small number of those hundreds of thousands of people who embraced the faith very quickly could be consolidated and help to build the framework of Baha'i community life. So by 1996, the House of Justice was able to look back over this period of time. Now it was almost then 75 years since the beginning of the formative age. And it was then about 40 years since the 10-year crusade when these first signs of accelerated growth were coming. And the House of Justice was then able to look at that pattern of experience and then begin to refocus the direction of the community. Before, we had these various threads of expansion, community building, child education, and so on, but we were pursuing them kind of all separately from one another. We had this large expansion, but we weren't able to integrate these other elements in a way so the process could be sustained over time. So beginning in 1996, with the four-year plan, the plans began to focus on a single aim. All of these other objectives all were carried forward, but now there was a single aim: how to advance the process of entry by troops. And all of these various elements and threads of activity had to be woven together into a single tapestry that would gradually be able to sustain a systematic growth in the Baha'i world. Now, this was a hard thing to do. We had already been spent four decades trying to do it and not being able to do it successfully, having fits and starts, bursts of people become Baha'is. Some communities would go up to 10, 20, 50,000 or more, and then the process would break down. Now we had to learn how to sustain that process of growth and not have it break down. So difficult was this challenge that the House of Justice gave a 25-year period from 1996 all the way to the year 2021. All of the plans during this period would focus on the single aim of learning how to advance the process of entry by troops, how to grow, how to balance expansion and consolidation in a systematic way so that we could initiate this growth and then sustain it over time. And this has been our focus then, since the four-year plan began, then followed by the 12-month plan, then the first five-year plan. Now we're in a second five-year plan. We're almost halfway through this 25-year process. Next year will be the midway point in this process. And in that time, we have learned a lot about the pattern of sustaining this systematic growth. What I want to do now is focus a little bit on what was the nature of this learning that we underwent. What was learned? The concept of learning is not an idea that has only come up in the activity of the Baha'i world since the four-year plan began. The concept of learning how to translate the teachings in action, including how to translate the teachings in action in the area of growth, has taken place since 1921 under the direction of Shoghi Effendi. For example, in 1939, he wrote to the Baha'is in India and Burma. He said, "Those believers who have the means and also the capacity to teach should be encouraged, no matter how great the sacrifice involved, to settle in these virgin territories until such time as a local assembly has been constituted, or at least a group of firm believers formed that can safely and gradually evolve into a firmly organized and properly functioning local assembly. This policy of teaching by settlement, which the Guardian has also advised and indeed urged the American believers to adopt, has been proven by experience to be the most effective way of establishing the faith in new territories, and therefore he confidently recommends it for adoption by your assembly." So this idea, it's not like this idea of pioneering, meaning moving a capable teacher to settle in a place and gradually raising up an assembly. It wasn't like we always had this idea. This was something that was developed by experience. It was proven by practice to be the most effective way. And then Shoghi Effendi, when it was proven, started encouraging national communities to start following that pattern. So then the pattern of pioneering became a part of all of our plans. Now we look at it, we can't imagine what would the Baha'i faith be without pioneering. But this was a process that had to be learned. Another quote, he said, "It has been found over the entire world that the most effective method of teaching the faith is the fireside meeting in the home. This method is far more effective than advertising in newspapers, public lectures, and so on. The Guardian is encouraging the believers over the world, including those on the home fronts, to engage in this method of teaching. So what happened? Well, the friends taught the faith. How? They put advertisements in newspapers. They organized lectures and so on. And then, somewhere, somebody invited somebody into their home and showed them hospitality and gave them a chance to ask questions. And this proved, by experience, to be an effective way to teach the faith. And the Guardian then began to encourage the believers all over the world to put that into practice. There's many statements like this. Our capacity wasn't as great as it is today. We didn't have as many communities. We didn't have as many believers and so on. But learning nevertheless took place. And in one place after another, on one topic after another, you can see Shoghi Effendi's focus on trying to learn and trying to be more systematic and trying to put the work on a systematic basis. And once something was learned, to spread that from place to place. For example, in Consolidation, he wrote, the highly salutary and spiritually beneficent experiment of encouraging a more active participation by these newly won supporters of the faith in Latin America and a greater assumption of administrative responsibility on their part in the ever-expanding activities to be entrusted wholly to their care in the years to come should be, in particular, developed, systematized, and placed on a sure and unassailable foundation. That was in 1949. He wrote that to Latin America. Now, they didn't do it then, but fortunately, they came along a little later and were able to systematize some approaches to consolidation. So one after the other, these things were focused on, and this capacity built. And what happened then, you see that as these lessons were learned, as experience was gained, then the capacity of the Baha'i community became much greater. For example, at the start of the 10-year crusade in 1953, now Shoghi Effendi had been the Guardian 32 years up to that point. All that time building the administration, gradually, patiently working with the Baha'is, helping them understand. One by one, getting national communities to adopt their national plan. It took many times to get that first national community to adopt a plan. He would ask them to do it, they wouldn't do it, he would come back again. Gradually, they initiated the plan. But with all that patient guidance and learning, at the start of the 10-year crusade, the Baha'is were able to collectively launch an enterprise where they accomplished more in 10 years than they had in a century of the development of the faith up until that point. Obviously, when Shoghi Effendi began his ministry, there were no national spiritual assemblies. By 1953, there were 12 national spiritual assemblies. By 1963, the end of the 10-year crusade, there were 56 national spiritual assemblies. 44 national spiritual assemblies formed in a 10-year period when it took almost a century just to form 12. In the first year of the 10-year crusade, 100 countries and territories were open to the faith. That was in a single year. That almost doubled the number of countries and territories that were open, all in a single year. Over the course of that period, we surpassed 11,000 localities and 5,000 local spiritual assemblies, all because we were able to learn from our experience and then become more systematic in our efforts. Now, the focus since 1996 has also been on this more systematic learning. At the time of the four-year plan, the House of Justice saw that if we kept repeating what we were doing for large-scale growth, it wasn't going to work. So they said, well, we need a different approach. For one thing, we can't just teach people and then leave them to themselves. If we're going to be able to sustain the process, then we have to learn how to take at least a percentage of the new believers who are taught and also make them effective workers for the faith so that they can teach the children's classes, and they can do the home visits, and they can organize the devotional meetings, and they can participate in the teaching campaigns, and they can consolidate the next thousands of people who come into the faith through the teaching process. So from the beginning of the four-year plan, one of the first things to focus on was the establishment of training institutes as a means of not doing the things that institutes had done up to that point, but learning how to systematically develop human resources from among the new believers who can then step immediately into the field of action. So now it's not a few hundred people bringing in tens or hundreds of thousands. As you bring them in, you also train them. Now, when the four-year plan began, there was an idea that what needed to be done was approach growth in a different way. Individuals, communities, and institutions would all become protagonists in a process where all these elements were woven together, and expansion and consolidation would go hand in hand. Institutes were a part of it. But for the most part, we didn't know how to do these other elements. And so what it came down to was the whole four-year plan was pretty much the only thing that came out of it was the establishment of these training institutes. And some countries even weren't able to accomplish that in the first 4 years. So when the 12-month plan came along then, the House of Justice encouraged every national community that hadn't yet done so to operationalize their institute, and then to begin working with children's classes and begin learning about area growth programs in a few places. So that this process then, which was established in 1996, by the start of the five-year plan in 2001, the House of Justice was able to speak of a wealth of experience that was accumulating and the elements of a system that can meet the training needs of large numbers. So the plan focused on two essential movements: the movement of people through a sequence of courses of training, and then the movement of various geographical regions, clusters, through various stages until they could establish an intensive program of growth. At that point, in 2001, the House of Justice couldn't describe exactly what an intensive program of growth was supposed to be, because nobody had done it. All it could say in looking at the experience from the 12-month plan was what were some of the prerequisites for establishing an intensive program of growth, like to have a cadre of people who were able to take on the responsibility for growth in their region, a few local assemblies and a few strong communities, an institute process, and so on. So some of these signs of what would be prerequisites were able to be described. But then it took most of that 5 years just to figure out what an intensive program of growth would look like. So clusters had to be established, communities had to be mobilized, they had to start a pattern of activity. Somewhere around 2004, the first intensive programs of growth were started. And then by the end of that plan, we had several countries where a very effective growth program was in place. We had something like 17,000 clusters in the world at that point. Only 100 or so had reached the point where we had an intensive program of growth. And out of those, only a smaller percentage actually were able to show growth and to be able to sustain it. Nevertheless, by 2006, the start of this plan, the House of Justice was able to point out that the elements required for a concerted effort to infuse the diverse regions of the world with the spirit of Baha'u'llah's revelation have crystallized into a framework for action that now only needs to be exploited. So in the letter introducing the current five-year plan, the House of Justice was able to summarize the experience of that first 10 years and outline all of the elements of the framework that worked. Because if it happened in one country or 30 countries, then it was only a matter of taking that framework, sharing it with the friends in other parts of the world, and then adapting it to the experience of their own cluster. So this was the focus then. The current plan that we're involved in, the aim is to take that pattern of action to 1,500 clusters in the world. And establish intensive program of growth in at least 1,500 clusters. Another aspect of learning, another illustration of it, was the concept of study circles. In 1996, the House of Justice talked about the idea of institutes, and they said that the courses should be delivered in a central location and at a distance. And everybody pretty much knew what a central location was. You bring everybody to a kind of a summer school setting, you have them sleep there, you give them a course and so on. But the idea, it was very unclear, how do you offer that at a distance in a village or in a town somewhere, that you couldn't have that same system. So what different communities tried different things, and then the idea of a study circle was born, where you would have a tutor, they would take a small group of people, they were able to offer that course at a distance. In 1996, we didn't have the concept of study circle. By 1998, when the national communities came to the International Convention, the House of Justice was able to share that experience, and now there isn't an institute in the world that doesn't have study circles as the primary vehicle for the delivery of these courses of the institute. In 2001, the House of Justice described certain activities of community building that were fundamental to community building. The idea of having a devotional meeting open to everybody, not just to the Baha'is. It's hard to remember, maybe way back in those days, but Baha'is used to have meetings to pray, and only the Baha'is would come to it. That was it. We didn't think about having devotional meetings for a wider population. Another thing was children's classes. Another thing was study circles. And all we were encouraged to try to open up and offer these to the wider society. Well, 1 year later, it was noticed that in the places where people tried to do this, these activities, besides being the foundation of a pattern of community life where we worship together, study the Word of God together, educate our children together, these things also prove to be portals for this process of entry by troops. Activities where large numbers of people who weren't Baha'is could come, experience the faith, and do the things that Baha'is do, and then become attracted and want to participate further. So the House of Justice described then these activities as core activities and encouraged their multiplication in all parts of the world. So one by one, various things like this were learned. What is an intensive program of growth? How does it operate? What is the administrative machinery that we need in order to guide the process of entry by troops? At the national level, at the regional level, with the institution of regional council, at the cluster level, through the institute and through the area growth committees and so on. All of these had to be learned. The concept of junior youth, working with this age group, if you put them in the children's classes, they weren't interested, they disrupted the classes. If you put them in the study circle, they drove out all of the youth and adults who didn't want to participate with them. This age group needed its own particular focus, and gradually materials were developed for them until that junior youth activity could become a fourth core activity, another portal for opening the door to large numbers of people, perhaps one of the most promising as far as the future. Also, the role of tutors. From the beginning process of having a veteran believer offer almost a study course, to understanding the idea of tutor as accompanying a person into the field of action, so that practices became an intimate part of the learning in a study circle. Now, learning doesn't take place without difficulty. Again, it's like the idea of a baby that takes its first steps and falls down. That's not a failure. The way human beings learn is by making mistakes. So we didn't learn all of these things and by magic find solutions to all these problems without challenges and difficulties. We had many obstacles in our path. People moved through the sequence of courses too quickly. They left out key practices. And then, so we would have many, many people who completed the whole sequence of courses, but then you wouldn't see any additional activity in the cluster. The cluster wouldn't advance. Or you had individuals who did the study and they would also multiply core activities, but then nobody would come. So we had to learn, well, how do you learn to invite them and get them to come? Somehow the word got out that because non-Baha'is were being invited to study circles and they became attracted to the faith and became Baha'is in those study circles, that the only way to teach the faith was in study circles. And now everybody should stop every other way of teaching, including there shouldn't be any firesides and so on. This despite the fact that the House of Justice was writing at the same time, saying that there should be firesides. But somehow the word got out, no, there shouldn't, and so people would stop their fireside. So all of these things were natural parts of the learning process. These and many other mistakes and challenges that we faced over the past decade. But what emerged now that we're seeing, and particularly there was one key element of this learning process that was still missing up until this last year. We saw many clusters in parts of the world that were able to establish this whole pattern of action, have lots of activity, even have lots of friends and neighbors and coworkers participate in activities, but the growth was very small. We would have intensive programs of growth, for example, clusters with intensive programs of growth, where two people would become Baha'is in a cycle, or maybe none. The friends would go through the activity, but they couldn't quite solve this problem with teaching. Then in the course of this year, an acceleration of learning in this last problem that was facing us began to take place. What would happen was basically three kind of key elements were added in the focus on teaching. One was to make sure that in the intensive teaching phase, you weren't just encouraging people generally to teach, but you were also organizing collective teaching activity during that period, 2 weeks or so. So the friends would organize teams, come together, pray, go teach the faith to the community of interest, to the various receptive populations, and then come back and talk about what they were doing and continuing to improve it. The second thing was a focus on Anna's presentation, the presentation of the faith in Book 6. Instead of taking all kinds of very indirect ways of teaching the faith, now the focus was on how to focus the presentation and take somebody from wherever they were to the point where you could invite them to become a Baha'i. And the third key element was to take certain individuals who lived in clusters where they were experiencing growth, maybe one place where they had 20, 30 people become Baha'is during the cycle, and then have them go to other parts of the world where they hadn't had that experience, another cluster that hadn't seen the growth, and they would share what they did, how they organized, how they prepared the teachers, and so on. Well, once this process began following the Rizwan message this year, suddenly in cluster after cluster, we saw quite a remarkable change. Somebody would go from, and you've heard many of these stories in the Tuesday morning prayer, somebody would go from the Lumbumbashi cluster in the DRC where they were having 40 enrollments per cycle, go to the Bangui cluster in CAR where they were having about two or three, and suddenly in that cycle, Bangui would have 70 new Baha'is. Now, not just enrollments, but people that they would then begin to incorporate in the core activities. Suddenly from all parts of the world, Pakistan reported about 1,000 Baha'is in a cycle. Philippines, a significant increase. Latin America had more new believers in a 2-week intensive teaching phase in one cycle than they had in the previous plan. We have seen in this plan, in terms of, again, all of this learning now coming together has shown a dramatic change in the activity that's going on in the world. In the first year of this 5-year plan, we had more enrollments than any year of the first 5-year plan. This is kind of an unprecedented thing where one plan ends and the next year you actually have more enrollments than you had in the previous plan. Usually when that happens, the last year of the plan, teaching goes up, the first year of the next plan, it goes back down. This time, the teaching results went up. In this year, so far, in the first 6 months of this year, we had 80% of the total enrollments that we had all of last year. That was just in the first 6 months. So at this point in time, we have approximately 275,000 people who have completed book one. 45,000, more than 45,000 who have completed book seven. We have at any given time 13,000 study circles, 20,000 devotional meetings, more than 10,000 children's classes with 100,000 children, 4,500 junior youth activities with 40,000 junior youth in it, more than 125,000 non-Baha'is who are participating in all these activities in any given moment, and 400 intensive programs of growth as we move on our way toward this 1,500. It's important to keep in mind that the purpose of all of this activity then is not just teaching for teaching's sake, not just an increase in numbers or growing the Baha'i community. This growth, this systematic execution of the divine plan is necessary to lay the foundation so that the Baha'i community has the capacity to then start acting in the world, putting the teachings into action in the area of social and economic development, in the area of a greater involvement in the life of society, applying the teachings to change ourselves, our own families, and our communities, and also be involved in the world to put Baha'u'llah's teachings into action, to begin to tackle problems like extremes of wealth and poverty, lack of education, inequality between men and women, and so on. That's the purpose of these plans. Now, as we look back on this now, 90 years since the Divine Plan was written, we think about those heroic souls who have achieved these objectives. And we look ahead to the next hundreds of years into the future and the various stages of the Divine Plan that will unfold in plan after plan. We have to get a sense of the kind of individual, this spiritual warrior, this member of this army of light, who's supposed to be the executor, the protagonist in this divine plan. The first thing we need to consider is the idea of just the whole terminology in itself. I mean, if you think about it, the aim of the Baha'i Faith is the most great peace. You know, we don't believe in killing. We'd rather be killed than to kill somebody. Why all this war terminology? What is this about warriors and conquering and so on? What's the purpose of that language? Well, I think at least in part, it's the idea of what is evoked when you think about war. War is really an existential issue. What it means is that your way of life is now challenged, what you believe in, your family, your freedom. All of these things are at stake to such an extent that somebody's willing to sacrifice their life in an enterprise to protect those things. So in using this kind of terminology, Baha'u'llah, Abdu'l Baha, and Shoghi Effendi are trying to raise our vision to understand what's at stake here. It's not just something that we can do, kind of a nice little thing to do on the side as we do all the other things in our life. You don't fight a war on the weekends and come back and do the regular things in your life. War means everything's at stake, and you commit everything to the battle. Baha'u'llah said, "We have decreed that war shall be waged in the path of God with the armies of wisdom and utterance, and of a goodly character and praiseworthy deeds." So our definition of war, what war means, is in a certain sense turning the whole concept inside out. It's not war with weapons. It's not about destruction. It's not about conquering people and subjugating them. It's about a process of liberation, something that's done with the tongue. To do battle, Abdu'l-Bahá says, doth not, in this greatest of all dispensations, mean to go forth with sword and spear, with lance and piercing arrow, but rather weaponed with pure intent, with righteous motives, with counsels helpful and effective, with godly attributes, with deeds pleasing to the Almighty, with the qualities of heaven. It signifieth education for all mankind, guidance for all men, the spreading far and wide of the sweet savors of the Spirit, the promulgation of God's proof, the setting forth of arguments conclusive and divine, the doing of charitable deeds. So this war we're engaged in is a spiritual process, one of educating and uplifting humanity. But like any other war, that means sacrifice. That means something has to be expended. And that is what we're called upon to do. The stakes in this battle, even though it's a spiritual process, are very high. In the past year, we saw the effect of this. For example, in this effort of 54 young Baha'is, ranging from 18 into their 30s, who were participating in activities in Shiraz in order to help educate young junior youth in underprivileged areas. They were arrested in May 2006, were put on trial in August 2007. And last month, three of these individuals were put into jail for the same kind of activities that you're going to be learning about tomorrow. Nothing, their aim was not even teaching in this case. They were using breezes of divine confirmation to help educate these underprivileged kids. But because these were books that Baha'is use in other countries, because they were trained to do this using Ruhi materials, they were arrested. They were charged with indirectly teaching the Baha'i faith. And that's why these three were put into jail. In other parts of the world, the battlefield is different. It's not that form of oppression against the faith, but the Baha'is are facing other kinds of obstacles. They're facing, in some cases, extreme poverty. It makes it very difficult to dedicate your time to advancing the plan when you're also wondering, how will you feed your family? What will your future be? How will you get an education? Can you even afford to raise your children, and so on? The opposite of this spectrum, in countries where there's great wealth, Baha'is are facing the obstacle of this materialism, which doesn't create an immediate hardship, but which seduces you and draws you away from objects of a spiritual life toward other kinds of enterprise, kind of seducing you toward the kind of activity that makes you ineffective in this larger campaign. So the nature of this battlefield is different. It's formed by different kinds of forces, by materialism, by oppression, by immorality, irreligion, fundamentalism, prejudice, all of these different kinds of things. Shoghi Effendi said that the friends must at all times bear in mind that they are in a way like soldiers under attack. The world is at present in an exceedingly dark condition spiritually. Hatred and prejudice of every sort are literally tearing it to pieces. We, on the other hand, are the custodians of the opposite forces, the forces of love, of unity, of peace and integration. And we must constantly be on guard, lest through us these destructive, negative forces enter into our midst. In a war, you basically have three options. One, you can surrender. So as these forces assail you, you can just give in to them, and then they take you away. Another thing is you can collaborate with them. This becomes a very tricky kind of a thing, because now what happens is, unless you're very careful, and this is something really that one individual can't even judge in terms of another, it's something we have to look about and think about ourselves. These different kind of forces that are operating the world can seduce us, can attract us, can draw us away from the kinds of activity that we should be engaged in order to defeat these forces and draw us into it. So our life becomes caught up in the same kind of consumerism, subtle kinds of prejudice, various kinds of educational superiority and things. Things that, on the one hand, the very seductive nature of these things is they define excellence for you. So to be excellent is to get a good education, to get a good job, and to become very accomplished in the world, and so on. Now, on the other hand, we know as Baha'is too, we should get an education. We should get a good job. We should become accomplished in the world. How do you tell the difference between one and the other? Sometimes it can be very difficult to see. But what a Baha'i should be doing at all times, in whatever conditions, whatever the face of the battlefield that you're engaged in, you know that your job is to translate the teachings into action and to take on the level of sacrifice and commitment it takes in order to put these teachings into effect. So the world is the way it is because it's shaped by these forces. And if we're going to change that social reality, then we have to be the champions of different kinds of forces and take different kinds of actions. And though outwardly some of the things might be the same, in every way, we have to make sure that the qualitative aspects of the teachings are put into effect. Finally, and most directly, our job is to fight. Our job is to be aware, to be conscious of these forces, to see how they act in the world, but to also understand Baha'u'llah's teachings, and then to make whatever sacrifices are necessary to put those teachings into effect in our lives, in our families, and in our communities. Now, these implications, I think, are particularly important for us at the Baha'i World Center as well. You know, you can think that, well, we come here to the World Center, we can't teach, so we're not engaged in the execution of the divine plan anymore. Sure, we can prepare ourselves, we can study, we can go to certain courses. There's a quotation from Shoghi Effendi where he says that he talks about the importance of love and harmony among the friends. He said, our main purpose after teaching should be to find those friends who are a little disheartened and encourage them, to see where the germs of discord exist, and with that abundant love which the Master has created in our hearts, establish peace and harmony. So if we think about this, as we make all these strenuous efforts for teaching, what if in the times that we couldn't teach, we made equally strenuous efforts toward building unity and harmony? We sought out, as eagerly as we look for a receptive soul, we seek out that Baha'i who's a little disenchanted, who's a little marginalized, who's alone, who maybe is a little bit in despair, and we reach out to them with love and unity. This is something that's needed across the Baha'i world, but it's something that's particularly needed here as well. But it's more than this even. We have to appreciate the significance of this spot. This is the spiritual and administrative center of the world. The operation of this divine plan flows out from here, from this place. The spiritual forces, the administrative direction comes from this place. So when you come here, you don't step out of that activity of the plan. You step into this place that's the center and the heart of the Baha'i world. Anything that happens here ripples out and is effect throughout the world. So for example, how the Israelis look at us. Well, what their impression is shaped by you and your encounter at the grocery store, when you go out to a restaurant or whatever. How they think of the Baha'is is shaped much more by what your interaction with them than anything the House of Justice can do in a formal way. When the visitors and pilgrims come here, they come to imbibe the spirit of this place, and then maybe for once in a lifetime activity, life-changing activity, they come here and they lay their head on the threshold of Baha'u'llah. How do we treat them? How do we interact with them? Do we help to reinforce their experience and then send them back as strong transform agents to affect their communities? Or do we distract them from this process? Even maybe in a way to offer some social activity, they end up being drawn into our social activities rather than participating in the spiritual process of their pilgrimage. Your own families are affected by your service here. Your peers, what you say to them, what you tell them about this place. When you leave the cluster where you return, all of these feel the impact of your service, of your discourse, of your practice of spiritual disciplines, your expression of arts, your work ethic, your love, your unity, your bond with the House of Justice. All of these things affect all of these audience and affect yourself and your ability to play a part in the divine plan. If it comes down to a question of policies and procedures, it's already gone too far, friends. You have to understand what the nature of this place is and your part in it. You have to take ownership for the faith. You have to take ownership for all these processes. And your action directly affects these things. If you're looking through the policies and trying to see, can I do this or can't do that, then probably it's too late already. The House of Justice really doesn't want to sit there and write policies. It usually writes a policy when things have gone too far already, so all right, it has to draw a boundary. But if you see that, well, there's a policy that says I can't do this, I really want to do this thing. Or there's a certain kind of party we can't have, certain kind of musical expression or arts expression that we want to have, we can't have it. The aim is not to restrict you. The House of Justice, again, has better things to do than sit down and say, what can we stop the youth from doing at the World Center today? But if you recognize the purpose of this place, if you see the battle that's being raged, that's raging throughout the world, if you think of some of your contemporaries who last month have gone to jail executing their role in this battle, then you see the reason for some of these things. Then you see the reason for the wise handling of funds. Even if the friends are generous enough to make sure that we have the resources we need, it doesn't mean now that we have no emergency for money so we can spend on whatever we need. We still need to exercise that wise economy set by the Guardian so that we can take those resources and send them out to the forefront of the battle. So you have a very direct role to play in that. All of us do, whether you're 18 or whether you're 80 serving here. Now, friends, I want to conclude with one last thought. At the time when Shoghi Effendi became guardian, when he was looking at these great responsibilities that he was going to have to fulfill, he was overwhelmed. He was overwhelmed by grief at the loss of Abdu'l-Bahá. He didn't benefit from any last instructions from him. He got here too late. He had already passed away. Immediately, the faith was attacked by the covenant breakers who tried to get the properties and resources of the faith. When they weren't successful by going to the government, they seized the keys to the shrine, for example. He had to deal with the believers. Some, of course, expressed their adoration and support for him. But others felt, well, he's too young. How can look at Abdu'l-Bahá, look at this young man, how can he take on the responsibility that Abdu'l-Bahá did? Maybe the House of Justice should be formed right away. And Shoghi Effendi even thought about that, but when he brought some of the believers here and he saw how immature some of them were, their own desire for power, he knew that the Baha'i world wasn't ready for that step. And he said about this process of building the administrative machinery in all parts of the world. Indeed, it took him, he looked to form a secretariat immediately, but there weren't any people that he could draw upon. He had to wait more than 20 years before he could finally create the International Baha'i Council, 30 years before he could create the International Baha'i Council and have some people here to assist him. Overwhelmed by this, Shoghi Effendi in the early years at sometimes he had to go off. He did the best he could, but when he saw especially the activities of the friends, their weaknesses, their disunity, the way that they were becoming obstacles to the spread of the faith, it became really too much for him, and he had to retreat, to go to Europe, and to regather his strength. Leroy Ioas, a hand of the cause, who was here toward the end of Shoghi Effendi's life, assisting Shoghi Effendi, talked with the Guardian about those early days. And he shared in one of his talks something that the Guardian shared with him. He said that Shoghi Effendi was a very remarkable young man, and he worshipped Abdu'l-Bahá. And when Abdu'l-Bahá passed away, the whole world became dark for him. When he returned to the Holy Land, he had in mind from the things which Abdu'l-Bahá had said to him, and this is what Shoghi Effendi told Leroy Ioas. He said, "I had in mind that Abdu'l-Bahá would give me the honor of calling together the great conclave which would elect the Universal House of Justice. And I thought in his will and testament that that was probably what he was instructing to be done. But," the Guardian said, "instead, I found out that I was appointed the guardian of the cause of God. I didn't want to be the guardian of the cause. In the first place, I didn't think that I was worthy. In the next place, I didn't want to face these responsibilities. I didn't want to be the guardian. I knew what that meant. I knew that my life as a human being was over." He said, "I didn't want it, and I didn't want to face it." So, Shoghi Effendi continued in his discussion with Leroy Ioas, "Remember, I left the Holy Land, and I went up to the mountains of Switzerland, and I fought with myself until I conquered myself. Then I came back, and I turned myself over to God, and I was the guardian. Now," he said, "every Baha'i in the world, every person in the world, has to do exactly the same thing. Whether you are a hand of the cause, whether you are a knight of Baha'u'llah, whether you are a member of a national assembly, whether you are a teacher, whether you are a pioneer, whether you are an administrator, regardless of what you are, whatever you are doing in the cause, every Baha'i must fight with himself and conquer himself. And when he has conquered himself, then he becomes a true instrument for the service of the cause of God, and not until that. And he will not achieve as great a success until he has done it. This is what every Baha'i in the world should know." I want to conclude with these words of Shoghi Effendi as we think about our part in the execution of this divine plan. "With hearts united, with minds purified, and with a determination never to waver or surrender, let us step into the arena of service and, armed with the sword of utterance and teaching, combat effectively the ills and sicknesses of this distracted world." Thank you, friends.